where other Americans chose between the major political parties, primarily based on whether their family preferred evangelical Protestantism or those denominations tending more toward ceremony and tradition, including but not just Roman Catholicism. Utah citizens were divided between Mormons and so-called Gentiles or non-Mormons. This alignment spawned a great deal of rivalry and bitterness and was ultimately disbanded only through the result of a combination of rather unique outside pressures. This will be the subject of this paper. After years of frustration at being hopelessly outvoted by Latter-day Saints, fully dominated by political affairs by their ecclesiastical leaders, some Gentiles began considering means of alleviating that condition. Encouraged by the schismatic Godbeite movement, both participants and outside non-Mormon observers hoped would become widespread through the territory since it stressed political independence. Corinn citizens, led by Irish Catholic Dennis Toohey, called for a territorial convention to meet there on Independence Day, 1870. After some initial conflict with Godbeites over their continuing espousal of plural marriage, the Liberal Party was finally organized to combat Mormon domination in Utah politics. So the Liberal Party is the anti-Mormon, including the former Mormon Godbeites. Thereafter, the local strategies, often aimed at nullifying Mormon votes on the grounds that some such participants were not sufficiently American in their primary allegiances. Related efforts aimed at generating national legislation and sentiment not only to enforce anti-polygamy laws, but also to assure the non-Mormon minority, including appointed territorial officials, would dominate Utah governmental affairs. In this, they were often successful during the ensuing two decades. In 1889, after polygamists and women had been banned from election participation by the Edmunds-Tucker Act, and many Mormon immigrants denied citizenship by liberal court officials, control of Ogden's municipal government was won for the first time by the anti-Mormon party. Fraudulent voting and ballot counting were widely alleged, but to no avail. Soon after Liberal Mayor Fred Kiesel and his associates took office, marked changes commenced in the metropolis. Liquor laws were relaxed. The supervision of vices was considerably slackened. The reputation of Ogden's 25th Street Red Light District began at that time. Several Gentile territorial officials voiced concern about the changes, but virtually nothing was done about these conditions. The situation was similar in Salt Lake City. Latter-day Saint church officials attempted to colonize residents from outside communities in the city long enough for them to qualify to vote and encourage those eligible for citizenship to properly qualify. But liberals effectively blocked both efforts. And on the other hand, the rival party successfully registered a considerable number of Gentile railroad workers from along the Denver and Rio Grande line then being constructed. The campaign was long and bitter. And on election day, as expected, liberal officials were often allowed their biases to determine who could vote and who could not. The liberal candidates won sufficiently large majorities to thwart church plans to contest the elections. Amidst the loud victory celebrations, the Deseret News editor, Charles W. Penrose, could only lament, quote, "It was not a victory gained, but a robbery consummated," end quote. The Salt Lake Herald agreed, saying, quote, we do believe there was rarely, if ever, a more crooked election, end quote. The Salt Lake Mormons thus experienced the trauma of seeing their beloved city pass into the hands of men widely regarded as enemies, simply the first of a whole series of related shocks they would suffer in the next several years. Inauguration of the new regime ushered in something of a real estate boom, as some of its backers had predicted. When the weather cleared, some property increased in value 5- and 6-fold over recent sales prices, and municipal government improvements to water, sewer, and streets, much needed for a long time, were implemented at what church observers considered exorbitant costs. Naturally, property taxes also rose, with newly elected assessor E.R. Clute enjoying what was widely perceived to be an inherent inducement to raise such assessments, receiving a 2.5% retainer on all taxes collected. Valuations were reportedly increased 400%, partly because the values increased by the boom. But to many Mormon citizens, the entire situation only appeared to be typical liberal corruption. Despite the fact that more police were employed than ever before, the city quickly filled with a tough, lawless element, which brought a marked increase in robbery, burglary, and assault. The Herald stated that, quote, "There never was a time when the criminal element in the city was more numerous, more vicious, more daring, or more desperate," end quote. Even the Liberal Tribune, the organ of the anti-Mormons, was compelled to agree. But despite loud and varied protests on all of these matters, little was done to alleviate the situation. The Mormon citizens could only resent their new position of helplessness as the out-of-power element of voters. But this situation undoubtedly persuaded church leaders of the need for change, helping them become more inclined to heed the advice of outside advocates, Republican advisors a little bit. The presidency issued the Anti-Polygamy Manifesto in September 1890. Prominent Republican leader Morris M. Estey, chairman of the most recent party national convention, explained that effective public relations work was needed to convince the nation that the LDS Church had indeed changed political as well as marital practices. It was widely observed that Utah's unique political divisions, based primarily on religious affiliation, were incompatible with mainstream American politics, and Estey stated outsiders needed to be shown that, quote, "the Mormons were at liberty to vote according to their political convictions and not according to the dictates of the priesthood," end quote. The outside advisor also urged that harmony in local affairs was needed, which undoubtedly had reference to the long-standing bitterness between the anti-Mormon liberal and the Mormon People's Parties. Although there was no immediate action forthcoming, Mormon authorities resolved to seek, quote, "to establish greater harmony between Mormons and Gentiles in Utah," end quote. Just prior to that time, contemporary Utah historian Edward Tullidge accurately predicted that after the Liberal Party had won control of government in the territory's two largest cities, Utah politics would become reconstructed under the regular organizations of Democrats and Republicans. He further predicted that Weber County would set the example for Salt Lake, which proved to be true. The main catalyst at Ogden was the seemingly undemocratic nature of the process of selecting the liberal ticket of candidates for the election in 1891. This prompted the non-Mormon critics of the slate to unite with People's Party activists in an effort to defeat the extreme liberals. The election was close, with neither faction able to claim complete victory. But the coalition, including the Mormons, elected the candidate for mayor and 7 out of 20 other offices. The main Ogden newspaper, The Standard, lauded the outcome as ushering in a new era, end quote, which religious prejudice would cease to be a figure, end quote, expressing hope that recent developments would prove the city was, quote, "the first to avail herself of the disposition of just men to divide on the broader issues," end quote. Within a week, a group of non-Mormons commenced organizing regular Republican Party in Ogden and soon welcomed Frank J. Cannon, a son of one of the most prominent Latter-day Saint general authorities, to be one of its officers. Soon after, the Democrats had a similar organizational meeting, and amidst the proceedings, Charles C. Richards, son of a LDS apostle, was given one of their party offices. By that time, Frank Cannon and members of the Weber State Presidency had conferred with the First Presidency of the Church, reporting that the Liberal Party in Ogden had broken up in order to allow citizens to choose between the national parties. They stated that their non-Mormon friends were urging the People's Party, the Mormon Party, to do likewise. After taking the matter under advisement, the Presidency concluded to encourage Ogden Church members to combine with the national parties. This was considered something of an experiment, limited thus far to Weber County, but it was certainly a significant beginning. Later in the spring, a similar division movement developed in Salt Lake City. Here it was the Democrats who initiated organizational efforts, with the crucial first meeting held in the office of sometime territorial official Frank Dyer, May 5th, 1891. A resolution was adopted stating Utah political parties, quote, should be formed upon the lines of national politics, leaving each individual citizen to choose for himself his affiliation with one or the other, end quote, major party. The Salt Lake Tribune expectedly opposed any such action, although it affirmed willingness to reconsider if the authorities. The church organ, the Deseret News, applauded the resolution, and editor Penrose encouraged People's Party members to attend Democratic meetings in order to study the issues, at least from that party's perspective. He also stated it would seem, quote, self-preservative for the Republicans to announce where they stand on the issues presented by their political opponents, end quote. The relatively new Salt Lake Times also prodded local Republicans toward action, observing that since the Democrats had determined to withdraw from the old Liberal Party and establish their own organization, there would be little reason for the rival party not to do the same. For most of a week, this theme was persisted in by the newspaper, that the Republicans should not sleep while the Democrats mustered their forces. Perhaps the decisive action in starting toward a Utah branch of the grand old Republican Party, independent of the Liberals, was Latter-day Saint Apostle John Henry Smith visiting one of the most respected Gentile Republicans, Territorial Chief Justice Charles S. Zane. At that time, the church authority confessed his fervent belief in Republican principles and stated that since the Democratic Party was organizing, quote, if the Republican Party did not, it would be in a minority when it does, end quote. He stated that many Mormons were Republicans at heart and asked the judge if he was in favor of division on national party lines. Zane responded that although he was not in a position as judge to be actively involved in such an effort, he too felt the Republican Party should be organized immediately. After also conferring with prominent Salt Lake banker W.S. McCormick and several members of the First Presidency, Smith resolved to, quote, go into the movement with the determined purpose of making Utah Republican, end quote. Nobody ever accomplished their purpose better than that. The Democrats held a mass organizational meeting in mid-May with no hint of disharmony between members of the dominant LDS Church and their former liberal opponents, with church delegate to Congress, John T. Kane, prominent in the proceedings. The Tribune denounced this as a marriage between the Democratic Party and the Mormon Church and called for continued opposition to church domination through the Liberal Party. Such appeals helped thwart the first attempt to similarly organize the Republicans, but finally on May 20th, the Republican mass meeting was held at the Salt Lake Theater. Several prominent former liberals, including C.W. Bennett and W.H. Dixon, participated. But the decisive event was Bennett calling Apostle Smith from the audience to the speaker's rostrum. Democratic observer Apostle Heber J. Grant assumed this was a disastrous mistake, assuming liberals present would shout down and humiliate his brother apostle. However, Grant and most others later conceded the move was effective. Smith declared that he was as free from church control as any person present and claimed many Mormons would never again hold allegiance to the Mormon People's Party. As the Times concluded, the speech, quote, cleared away doubt from the mind of every man who was at all inclined to be just, end quote. That members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were as likely to be unfettered in church affiliation as anyone else in political matters. Throughout these events, church leaders had noted opposition by the so-called Tribune Gang, and Apostle Abraham H. Cannon, at least, had concluded they were making a last-ditch effort to maintain the old antagonisms for the purpose of controlling the territory for their own corrupt purposes. According to Cannon, such efforts and intentions were influential in the final decision by church authorities to call a number of the People's Party to convene to disband that organization. It was clear that the First Presidency of the Church had also considered to consider National Republican Advisor MMSD's counsel to normalize Utah political affairs, with his party having a respectable showing. Thus, when the disbandment meeting was held at the Gardo House, which was the headquarters of the church at the time, on June 10th, 1891, one of the main themes was that it was not only important for individuals to choose a major political party to affiliate with, but to attempt to keep the party membership close to equal in numbers, about the same number of Democrats as Republicans. Another meeting of several dozen Mormon political activists held later the same day as the Gardo House disbandment featured advice from each member of the First Presidency. The diary entries of three other general church authorities present offer insights into the message conveyed. Apostle Franklin D. Richards recorded that, quote, the policy of the present political move, end quote, was explained and approved to all present. H. Cannon, in the Council of 70, soon to be an apostle, noted that the participants were informed that though the First Presidency, quote, desired the saints to join the different national parties, they did not want them to go en masse into either side, end quote. John Morgan in the Council of 70 added that they were, quote, advised that the present Democratic tendency was not what it should be, end quote, and that an equilibrium between the major parties should be sought. Indication that no undue pressure was asserted in favor of the Republicans is illustrated in the comments of longtime Democratic activist James H. Moyle, who queried concerning his well-known political preferences. He was informed by George Q. Cannon that, feeling as he did, he should definitely ally with the Democrats. Those who had not formed such allegiances were the only ones encouraged to consider joining the Republicans. Observing that there had been no objections to his suggestions, Moyle reflected no resentment at the advice detrimental to his party and observed that it did not seem to be a, quote, church fiat, end quote, either that the People's Party disband or that the striving for equilibrium, equal alignment, be fully carried out. It wasn't just a church dictate. The church was encouraging it, but individuals were taking the initiative. Since the Democratic Party began organizing first and had long been more friendly to Mormons than the Republicans, this attempt at equal division would not be easy. But it's clear that the advice from national Republican officials was sufficiently firm that the First Presidency asserted considerable efforts in that direction. Remember, Harrison had been elected president, so if they were going to get statehood, political independence, they needed to work with the Republicans. As they disclosed to Democratic lobbyist and sometime general authority John W. Young, the church leaders confessed they were, quote, exceedingly desirous that the Republicans should, on the start, find sufficient encouragement to enable them to make a struggle for territorial supremacy as close and interesting as possible, end quote. They assumed that if the parties were approximately equally balanced, they could work effectively for political independence statehood offered with both national parties. As A.H. Cannon had recently recorded, the prevailing concern in deliberations among the Mormon hierarchy was, quote, the danger of our people all becoming Democrats, end quote. He recalled the First Presidency had concluded that if but one party gathered strength from among the saints, quote, the result of such a course would doubtless prove most disastrous, end quote, assuming that the same kind of persecution endured in former years would be repeated by the slighted party when in power nationally. For that reason, church leaders were admonished that, quote, efforts should be made to instruct our people in republicanism and thus winning them to that party, end quote. The individual to implement this admonition was John Henry Smith. Assisted by two young charter members of the Utah Republican Party, John M. Zane and George M. Cannon, Smith held dozens of party organizational rallies at county centers throughout the territory during the summer of 1891. Perhaps of equal influence was the ecclesiastical tour of southern Utah Apostle Francis M. Lyman commenced soon after the Gardo House meeting. Lyman's activities at Beaver and possibly other localities that summer were probably the basis of the well-known legend arising from this era that the church authorities preached in the very as the church authorities preached in the various congregations. They divided the group Democrats and Republicans, and I haven't seen any actual documentation that happened. But Lyman did inquire at Beaver why there were so many Democrats and stated that the authorities desired us to divide about equally along national party lines in order that we could receive favors from whichever party was in power. He thereupon advised that, quote, those who had not already declared themselves Democrats and could conscientiously do so should ally themselves with the Republicans, end quote. And similarly, when he visited Washington County several months later, Lyman laid before the local brethren the political situation as he perceived it. He was quoted by his traveling companion, Apostle Anthony Lund, as saying, quote, there were too many Democrats here in St. George. We were told to divide, but here in St. George, you've turned in a body from the People's Party to the Democracy, end quote. He explained that since the Republicans dominated the national government, quote, they can do nothing. They can do something for us. The Democrats can't, at least not until March 4th next, end quote. On several occasions, Lyman advised that when a person had not yet taken sides in the political realignment, it was wise to consider the Republican Party in order to, quote, court the side that's in power, end quote. These actions certainly amplify the policy outlined by the First Presidency to the Apostles that crucial summer. Yet in spite of these efforts, as the territorial election of August 3rd, 1891 approached, it became clear that neither the infant Democrats or Republicans could defeat the still present Liberal Party without the assistance of the other. Despite some efforts by church leaders to deter any abandonment of the new parties, it's reasonably clear that individuals preferring Republican principles united with the Democrats in casting their ballots. Thus, the Democrats garnered 2/3 of the seats in the territorial legislature, while the Liberals gained the others, and Republicans won essentially nothing that year. Amidst rival newspaper accusations of betrayal, Democratic Party commentator Scipio A. Kenner explained that Mormon voters were not so opposed to each other as they were to the Liberals, and instead of aiming their entire political efforts against each other, quote, they expended part of their ammunition unitedly upon the common opponent, end quote. In the midst of a family fight, Kenner stated, the Liberal Wolf still had to be kept from the door. In that campaign, Apostle Lund was defeated in his Republican candidacy for the territorial Senate by a Democratic candidate from a neighboring county. This and other aspects of the campaign somewhat displeased the First Presidency. When anti-Mormon spokesmen continued to chide church leaders for interfering in political process, President Wilford Woodruff sarcastically replied, quote, as evidence of his interference in politics, he could say that he had very much desired to see some Republicans sent to the legislature, but not a single one had been elected, end quote. Opponents of church interference in politics had reason to distrust the contemporary statements of general authorities that they'd withdrawn from political involvement. But those statements fell on more believing ears among the church membership. And whether church leaders fully intended it or not, the more committed Mormons heard the affirmations of their right to political independence, the more they embraced such a principle virtually new to them. They hadn't been independent very long. They had listened to what their church leaders told them to do in politics. But independence is coming. The first experience of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints competing against each other in partisan politics was probably more than a little shocking to some. An otherwise obscure Ogden municipal election in March 1892 demonstrated not only some rather outrageous interference by at least one paid staff member of the First Presidency, George F. Gibbs, who quietly spread notice of his employer's will that Republicans win, but also some of the first opposition to the presidency by Apostle Moses Thatcher, a local apostle and a Democrat. Later in that year, during the regular territorial elections, Thatcher, strongly sympathetic to the Democrats, openly opposed both Joseph F. and John Henry Smith, who were equally partisan Republicans. This certainly demonstrated that the church authorities were no longer united in political affairs, although they had remained deeply involved, at least as individuals, in politics. The First Presidency continued to maintain close ties to persons nationally prominent in politics in their efforts to secure the political independence only statehood could assure. Among the most vivid examples of effective lobbying among leaders of both national parties was treatment of the liberal delegates at the national conventions in the summer of 1892. Those attending the Republican meetings at Minneapolis, Minnesota, discovered upon arrival, this would be the liberal, the anti-Mormons, discovered upon arrival that the pro-Mormon delegates had already been recognized and awarded the Utah seats. And although the liberals appealed and later received partial recognition, they realized the significant gains that had been made at their expense by the regular Republican organization of Utah. While among the first to arrive at the Chicago convention site, liberal Democratic delegation received virtually no consideration at the hand of their national party. John T. Kane and the pro-Mormon Democrat delegation were accorded full recognition and every demonstration of favor and friendship at those proceedings. Not long after the disappointment of the national conventions, the Utah Liberal Party attempted to regroup at its territorial convention. At this crucial gathering, called expressly to decide the party's future, only 8 of the 25 Utah counties were represented. Although a poll of the Central Committee indicated that the majority wished the party to remain active as a distinct political movement, one of the minority, Charles S. Varian, offered a resolution favoring dissolution. Part of his argument was that in view of recent actions at the national conventions, they had no choice but to consolidate with the national parties and continue their efforts to curb church influence from within that structure. Others agreed that the division movement had progressed too far to ignore and that they needed to get involved to make the best of the situation. Nevertheless, those liberals who disagreed continued their separate efforts for another year amidst numerous defections during that time. An example of the dilemma some former liberals faced is the situation of Charles Crane of Millard County. He recalled being a faithful opponent of church interference when such meant social ostracism in a predominantly Mormon area his fellows further north had never experienced. But at that time, he voiced great concern that with the recent division of Mormon voters on party lines, the Democrats had gained the ascendance in the legislature and from there could pass measures to enhance their party's interests. Yet he observed, quote, Utah should naturally and geographically be Republican. End quote. And when the people properly understood tariff protection and other Republican issues, he was confident they would become members of that party. That was the most divisive issue at the time, the tariff, and Brigham Young had preached protection, so Crane has good reasons to think Mormons would naturally be Republicans if they got a chance. Crane then stated that by, quote, longer adhering to the Liberal Party, we're giving the Democrats an open field, end quote. And when the former party's disrupted, quote, which they surely must be, we will be found with the bag to hold, the game having long since been captured, end quote. He did not blame those in areas where more non-Mormon voters were, where there were more non-Mormon voters for staying separate, but he personally pledged to work for the election of Republican legislators in Millard County in cooperation with church political activists. And before long, he would be the territorial chairman of the newly organized Utah Republican Party. Further illustrating the pressures on non-Mormons of Republican leanings is the situation of Territorial Governor Arthur L. Thomas. After the national conventions, he demonstrated willingness to help reconciliation of the rival branches of the party by appearing on the same speaker's platform with Frank J. Cannon, one of the most active Mormon politicians of that party. Later, Thomas called at the LDS Church headquarters to warn authorities of the negative influence of allowing the Deseret News to continue advocating statehood. At that time, Thomas affirmed his intention to work with the Republican Party in approaching elections. But something later forced him back into the liberal ranks. While it's impossible to determine the decisive pressure in this regard, it may well have been that during the party nominating convention, Gentile party members, assured they would be fairly treated, were disappointed that the Mormon candidate, Frank Cannon, secured the nomination for Congress rather than one of their men. Democratic liberal leader Orlando W. Powers claimed that such a development cost the rival party over 2,000 votes they would otherwise have garnered, probably including Thomas's. The Democrats won the elections anyway. Utah's socio-political structure had been, for years, probably the most completely divided of any area in the country, with the possible exception of the southern solid Democratic South, with blacks being the Republicans down there, but not being able to vote much, while the groupings were not the pietistic liturgical ones carefully delineated in recent years by Richard Jensen and Paul Kleppner, there was no doubt that religious preference, at least whether either favoring or opposing Mormonism, was the decisive factor in party divisions. It was probably unique that the territory's Catholics and Protestants were so largely able to subordinate their differences as they struggled together against the Mormon majority, although as they began the process of normalizing the party alignments, internal strife within the liberal ranks became far more noticeable. By 1893, the Liberal Party had essentially faded from existence in all except the prominent Utah mining districts and the two largest cities of the territory. Since defeat 2 years earlier, the party had not fared well in Ogden, but still held sway in Salt Lake City. However, the November municipal elections there saw many residents inclined to believe the Salt Lake Herald allegation that a, quote, malodorous, smelly city council was the exact antipodes of honesty and capability in its conduct of public affairs. Although more restrained in its comments, a group of several dozen prominent Mormon and Gentile businessmen issued an invitation for others concerned to gather and discuss the future course of Salt Lake City government. The public announcement mentioned that with the present financial distress gripping the region, amidst the onset of the worst financial depression yet in American history, the panic of 93 that year started a 5-year depression, it was impossible for the community to stand the strain they were now put under by present municipal extravagance. At a subsequent meeting, many Gentiles criticized the incumbent liberal administration and concluded that since there was more prudence and economy needed than could be expected from a political administration, a nonpartisan citizens' party would be formed to oppose the liberals for Salt Lake City offices. Although the Tribune called the revival of the People's Party, said it was a Mormon movement, only 9 of the 20 citizens' candidates were Latter-day Saints, and 6 of the Gentiles nominated had recently been active liberals. Besides the threat of the Citizens Coalition movement, liberals faced an even more formidable problem within their ranks. During the summer of 1893, a branch of the nativist, anti-Catholic actually, American Protective Association, by then widespread in the nation, was established in Salt Lake City. Though founded further east, the western branch of the organization was said by the leading historian of the movement, Don Kinzer, who is a colleague of Jan Shipp's in Indiana University. Kinzer said that it was more successful in the West. For example, it determined the outcome of the California gubernatorial election of 1894. I've written about that. Morris M. Estey was running for governor. The APA came to him and said, you've got to fire your Catholic housemaid that had been with the family for 30 years. He refused to do it and was blacklisted for that purpose and beaten for governor for not firing his Catholic housemaid. Reportedly, 600 strong in the Salt Lake County area, this organization, most often referred to as the Western Store or Amerines, was fundamentally anti-Catholic in its orientation. Over 20 elected and appointed city officials were listed by the press among the members, some of whom had allegedly pledged to remove all Catholics from the municipal employment rolls. The Salt Lake Tribune publisher, published by Catholic Patrick Lannan, was particularly outspoken in its criticism of the Amerines and their bigoted aims. In fact, there's a certain irony in the Tribune denunciations for practices strikingly similar to what it had long advocated toward Latter-day Saints. In its initial expose of the existence of the organization, the APA, the Salt Lake Herald raised the question of its relationship to the Liberal Party, then answered its own query by saying, quote, the very financial and social background of the Liberal Party is composed mainly of the Catholic element, end quote. And although local members of the APA officially denied their purpose being to break up the Liberal Party, one individual participant confessed, quote, "As members of the Liberal Party, we became tired of being manipulated, almost altogether by Catholics," end quote. It's difficult to assess the strength of this sentiment, as it is the power of the Tribune publisher Lannan and his friends behind the scenes of Gentile politics in Utah, but it appears to have been considerable in both cases. The Deseret News noted the considerable speculation on the relative strength of the Amerines and the Lannan Liberals, and predicted that neither faction was likely to make sufficient concessions to the other to enable the Liberals to be successful at the polls. At least three candidates of the Liberal slate were known to be Amerines, and some of their fellows sought to expand that number. The mayoral candidate, J.C. Conklin, refused to take a stand either for or against the APA, and may therefore have alienated both factions. At any rate, during the last days of the campaign, the matter caused the Herald to express confidence the Citizens Party candidate, Robert N. Baskin, was assured of victory in the mayor's race. The Tribune conceded that, quote, "If the Liberal ticket generally is not elected this fall, it will be because of the unrest and indignation which the Amerines as an organization have caused in this community," end quote. At the end of the campaign, the Anti-Mormon Tribune argued that, quote, "The mission of the Liberal Party was not yet ended," and chided former members by asking if they had not felt for a long time that they were too hasty in breaking their allegiance with the party, which for a time at least had redeemed Utah, putting it in Gentile hands. It's ironic that the Anti-Mormon Liberal Party in Utah, a coalition of diverse groups generally united for more than 20 years, would be totally destroyed by one of the periodic waves of Protestant antipathy toward Catholicism, but that was the case. The Liberals lost all but a minority of city council seats and the treasurer's office. Immediately after the election, in which the Liberals polled only half the votes they had gathered the year before, the Tribune conceded that the Liberal Party should soon disband. Interviews with a number of former anti-Mormon activists indicated a near consensus in that regard. Frequent party campaign manager Powers expressed belief that statehood was inevitable, and that with hindsight, it would have been better to accept Mormon professions of good faith earlier. Although he was clearly in favor of dissolving the Liberal Party, he stressed that such could not be accomplished by an individual or a newspaper, but must be done by assembled members themselves. This was finally carried out a month later. At that time, their longtime organ, the Tribune, paid tribute to the heroic effort to Americanize Utah. Quote, "They worked with the idea from the first that their final triumph would at the same time be the death of the party," end quote. Although there is abundant reason to consider other factors causing its demise, the feelings expressed at the mass meeting accomplishing the disbandment of the Liberal Party naturally affirmed that they had accomplished their purpose. There's no question that normalization of Utah politics could not have been accomplished without the impetus and cooperation of non-Mormons friendly to the church hierarchy and its interests. This includes both political advisors on the national scene and the less fanatical and sometimes self-serving among Gentile political activists in the territory. It's clear the birth of Utah's national parties could not have occurred so soon without firm pressure and even some threats to Latter-day Saint leaders by outside figures, particularly within the Republican Party. This is another irony, that the party exerting the heaviest hand by threatening the most ended up enjoying so much favor in Utah. It's equally certain that the Liberal Party would not have died without the appearance of the APA in Utah. Nevertheless, the territory was soon thereafter properly, quote, Americanized, and thus would soon enjoy statehood. That's the end of my paper. Thank you.
I told Leo at the beginning that I was a little bit reluctant to comment on his paper. The last time I was at a Sunstone symposium and had anything to do with a Lyman, it got me into a considerable amount of trouble. We've decided this is a different symposium and a different Lyman. I'm happy to have the opportunity to respond to Leo Lyman's excellent paper. I believe that an understanding of political developments in 20th century Utah requires an examination of events in the last decade of the 19th century. The decade of the 1890s is a key period of political accommodation and Americanization. For those of us interested in this facet of Utah's history, Leo Lyman has, in numerous articles and books, shed light on this crucial period. So my response, in large measure, concurs with what he has had to say here and elsewhere, while I will also, however, provide some additional thoughts on this issue. Let me begin by reading to you from Karl Marx's The German Ideology. The ideas of the ruling class are, in every epoch, the ruling ideas. In other words, the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships. The individuals composing the ruling class possess, among other things, consciousness, and therefore think. Insofar, therefore, as they rule as a class and determine the extent and compass of an epoch, it is self-evident that they rule also as thinkers, as producers of ideas, and regulate the production and distribution of the ideas of their age. Thus, their ideas are the ruling ideas of the epoch. I share this rather long quotation with you because it is my contention that the ruling class of late 19th century Utah, perhaps a better term would be the social, political, and economic establishment, is far broader than the Mormon hierarchy and, in fact, includes large segments of the non-Mormon community. Indeed, Utah's establishment, both Mormon and non-Mormon, increasingly came to reject the disagreements and assumptions of a previous epoch. Moreover, what this establishment was seeking in a period of insecurity was order, stability, and the normalization of economic and political life. Let's explore that contention in a little more detail. First, it seems to me that one cannot understand political developments in late 19th century Utah unless they are looked at as a part of larger national patterns. As one political historian has observed, during the period from 1875 to 1893, the American two-party system was never more evenly balanced for so protracted a period. Presidential elections were often close to a toss-up and were decided by the shift of a doubtful state. The Democrats enjoyed a clear majority in the Senate for only one of those nine Congresses. The Republicans boasted a majority in the House for only two of those Congresses. As the American political system sought to maintain balance, Utah became a key attraction to leaders of both major parties. In large measure, the efforts of the church to divide the saints into one or the other of these two major parties, despite all the legends notwithstanding, whether that actually happened by dividing wards and stakes, etc., I don't know. Nonetheless, it fits into this pattern of trying to maintain political balance. Second, I think it's important to remember that these years witnessed the appearance of agents of instability in the American body politic. Strikes and labor disputes, including the Great Homestead Strike, the Haymarket Riots, and others, were occurring with increasing frequency and bloody results. Moreover, new political movements like the populists and the socialists were challenging the American people to take a hard look at their political values, suggesting that perhaps there were other and better economic systems than capitalism. In part, the appeal of these groups was enhanced by the recurring economic woes of the 80s and 90s. These radical movements and these economic woes were found in Utah as well as elsewhere. Third, I believe that a number of younger Utah leaders, the best and the brightest, if you will, of the area's political establishment, both, again, Mormon and non-Mormon alike, recognized that the challenges and opportunities of the next century were far more significant than the religious conflicts that had long divided them. In both Mormon and non-Mormon circles, a new generation of leaders was emerging that was considerably less tied to the squabbles of the past. Fourth, I think it became increasingly apparent to many of these men, and they were all men, just about, that the best vehicle to bring about both political success and political stability was the Republican Party. Leo mentioned James Henry Moyle. Not everybody agreed with that assertion. Despite what Moyle had to say that Leo quoted, Moyle also referred to church leaders like Joseph Fielding Smith and John Henry Smith and Francis M. Lyman as political gumshoers, whose job it was to go around the state and organize the saints in behalf of the Republican Party. Nonetheless, I think that most people, this new emerging generation, saw in the Republican Party the vehicle to achieve stability and political success. I think particularly of my own studies of Parley P. Christensen, who was a Salt Lake County attorney, later a presidential candidate of a third party in the 1920s. As a student at the University of Deseret in late 1889, early 1890, he was elated, he said, nearly 50 years later in remembering it, when the Liberal Party achieved political success in the Salt Lake City municipal elections. He was the only person in his class to stand up and support the idea of the Utah Commission as coming in and regulating Utah politics. Within 2 or 3 years, however, this Jack Mormon from Cache Valley, who was very suspicious of the power of the Mormon hierarchy, found himself allied with the regular Republican Party in Tooele County, working closely with Apostle George F. Richards, serving as the Secretary of the State Constitutional Convention, and for more than 20 years trying to bridge attaining political success through the Republican Party while opposing the efforts of the church hierarchy. In fact, I think what this period does is set patterns for later developments. A long list of ties between of state politics. I think of the legacy of the abhorrence in Utah politics of the idea of a closed political primary. Political primaries, we don't believe, are really political matters. They ought to be public matters open to anybody, and people can move with fluidity between either political party or mass meeting. So the idea of balance is still there. It was most interestingly, I think, expressed recently in a suggestion that if Utah Democrats would simply reject their exotic and quixotic commitment to liberal issues, then people would be less inclined to perceive Utah as a one-party state. In other words, if the Democrats would simply act like Republicans, everything would be just fine. So what I'm saying is that increasingly, the ruling ideas of the epoch of early 20th century Utah revolved around the need for normalization, stability, and political balance. These were the ruling ideas of the ruling elite. And even, though obviously too much could be made of this point, the efforts in the first decades of the 20th century on the part of non-Mormons to oppose the church politically revolved less around the traditional religious divisions and more around the fear of hierarchical dominance of economic and political life. Why? Because such dominance threatened stability. Thus, I agree generally with Lyman's paper and Lyman's conclusion that Utah was properly Americanized. One minor quibble deals with his reference to the argument of liturgicals and evangelicals. This is a common theme in recent American historiography on American politics. Without getting into a long explanation, essentially the argument that's made by Kleppner and Jensen and others is that evangelicals became Republicans and liturgicals became Democrats. Now, I agree with him in terms of his assessment of the role of the APA in breaking up the Liberal Party. I think he's absolutely correct in that. It would be interesting to see the attitudes not just of the Deseret News, but of church leaders toward that particular phenomenon. Maybe he has access to them. I don't know. There is a larger issue, however, that I think bears some examination. I don't necessarily agree that Catholics and Protestants were particularly in accord just because of their opposition to Mormonism. In a recent book by Mark Banker, for example, he suggests that Presbyterians, who he's looking at, viewed Catholics, at least New Mexican Catholics, as un-American and threatening to stability and order as they did Mormons and Native Americans. So that's an area that we might want to explore at another symposium or another time. Particularly, it would be interesting to look, if possible, at the voting statistics. How did Utah's non-Mormons vote, particularly in the period just after the period we're talking about, when the two major parties are established in Utah? Now, that's difficult to find that information, and in fact, that's one of the criticisms of some of the historians who have used this this technique. To say that a county was 50% Catholic does not necessarily mean that those same numbers voted in any given election. Something to look at. In any event, Leo Lyman has provided an important assessment of the forces that brought about Utah's entry into the mainstream of American politics. My suggestion is simply to encourage him to continue his efforts to help us better understand what I think both of us agree is a most crucial period in Utah history. Thank you.
Thank you, Leo. Thank you, John. We have 5 minutes left for answering questions. I'd like to start by asking both of you if you could just clarify a little bit better what some of the issues were regarding the Republican and Democrat parties that attracted Mormons, I guess principally to the Republicans initially, and if they were specific issues that they liked, or was it mostly just for political reasons that they gravitated towards one or the other?
I've spent a lot of time in the book Political Deliverance discussing the opportunities of the Democrats for many years to deliver statehood for Utah, but the Mormons never would make any concessions on polygamy. And finally, the Congress that was controlled, the only one, as John mentioned, that was controlled by the Democrats, failed to deliver Utah statehood in 1888. And the church leaders, the first presidency, which was a committee on statehood, made a conscious decision to see what the Republicans could do now that they were in power. And Abraham Cannon and others actually say, the Democrats betrayed us, they had a chance, they didn't do it. And so it's more pragmatic, Mark. It's let's see what the Republicans can do for us. Now, there is some sincerity among those who have looked at the issues carefully. The Republican Party espouses protection of home industry against foreign competition. And that's what Brigham Young had been preaching for a generation, that the Mormons ought to be self-sufficient. What they can't make themselves, they should do without. And especially things like sugar factories are more compatible with the Republican issue on the tariff. That's basically the way I see it.
Some Utahns are also drawn away from the Democratic Party after 1896, particularly because the Democrats, in their words, are attached to the virus of free silver. And for many people who are interested in maintaining economic stability, they see in that inflationary politics and radical politics. That plays a factor. Beyond that, I think it's clear that in the minds of many of the people I've studied, at least, whether it's conscious or unconscious, they see in the Republican Party as the emerging political vehicle. And they say, why not attach ourselves to that party? Why not be on the ride the wave toward political success? The Democrats are fighting among themselves over silver and imperialism and a whole number of other issues. Let's go with the game that's going to win.
Which turned out to be the right game for them.
Absolutely, yeah. Dominates national and Utah politics, really, with some exceptions for 30 years.
Till 1930.
Yeah.
Are there any questions from the audience? We've got a microphone up here. If you could come up and state your question there so we can record it.
I have a couple of questions. And if you've answered them before I came, I apologize. The first was, what was the percentage of the population that made up this liberal anti-Mormon party at the time that it was so powerful? What was the percentage of the population of the territory that was non-Mormon?
I'd be guessing. I would say 10 to 15%. But in Summit County, in Eureka, in some of the mining districts, and in Salt Lake and Ogden, it would be almost half. In the mining districts, it would be more than half.
I would assume that. I wondered about Salt Lake and Ogden.
When women can't vote, and the highest number of those would be LDS, and when polygamists can't vote, and when those immigrants who should be able to become citizens are denied that by the territorial officials, it really doesn't matter in numbers. It's eligible voters, and in both cases, with the little ballot box stuffing, which was upheld, the Gentiles gained control for about a four-year period between 1890 and 1893.
Thank you. The second you almost answered. I grew up in Salt Lake during the Roosevelt era, mm-hmm. So I assumed at that time that we were a Democratic state. So when did you just say that the Republicans have been in power except for that period of time in Utah?
Yeah, except for that. Now, we've elected a lot of Democrat governors.
Yes,
and that's
that.
An interesting phenomenon. But from 1893 on, we've been a Republican state. And I mentioned in my paper the irony. The Republicans were the ones who passed most of the anti-Mormon legislation. Their very first political platform talked about the twin relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. And yet, when we become politically active nationally, we're as loyal Republicans as any state there is, and have remained that.
Except for those Roosevelt years.
Except for and a couple of, quite a few Democratic governors. But if you look at the U.S. senators, most of those have been Republicans, and the state legislatures especially.
Thank you.
In many ways, there has been a kind of a balance. Leo has mentioned governors, elected Democrats, other offices. Utah has tended to follow national patterns with a couple of exceptions in presidential elections, for example. From 1896 until 1976, with the exception of 1912 and 1960, Utah always voted the same way the nation went. 1912, Utah went for Taft largely because of Taft's endorsement by President Joseph Fielding Smith.
Only two states went for Taft that year, Utah was one of them.
Yeah. In 1960, Utah went for Nixon over Kennedy. Many observers believe because of a sort of a backhand endorsement of Nixon by President McKay. So it has fit in many ways in national patterns, and I think that's not just an accident. I think that was, I want to say intentional. I don't want to make this sound conspiratorial, but I think it was desired.
Could you comment on the persistent folklore of congregations being split? You mentioned that you saw no evidence, but is this folklore?
I once attended a dinner where I was sitting at the same table with the legendary Harvey Fletcher. And he could remember his father and uncle saying that happened in some Provo wards. But nobody ever wrote it down. Now, there were many times when Francis M. Lyman and John Henry Smith went to a stake presidency member and said, hey, the other guys are Democrats. Don't you think you ought to be a Republican? And really what happened was those who had been active in politics in the People's Party became Democrats. Those who are new to politics, including many stake presidents, follow the admonition of the first presidency and become Republican. And that's a very effective tool. If you can get these newly active people to be Republicans, you've got more than the Democrats have. In the last four elections before Utah statehood, the Republicans won all four. And that's amazing. When most Mormons had been favorable to the Democratic Party for the previous 40 years.
There's some nice ironies, though. One of my favorite is in the election, I think it was 1896, Democrat Martha Hughes Cannon is running for the state Senate in an at-large election, and one of the Republicans running against her is her husband, Angus M. Cannon. And when the votes are counted, Maddie wins and Angus loses. So there are a couple of ironies in all of that.
He's a stake president.
And he's the Salt Lake stake president, yeah. Beyond that, there's a very interesting challenge for these new Republicans. I think Leo's correct in that.
You have people like Senator Smoot trying to build a political machine that maintains Mormon support and non-Mormon support at the same time. And Smoot is very careful to not get attached to issues like prohibition, which are going to bother some of his supporters like Becker and Kiesel and others who are non-Mormons and brewers. And so Smoot always opposes prohibition. The president of the Mormon Church opposes prohibition, except what they call local option. In other words, counties that are overwhelmingly Mormon can adopt prohibition, but let's not raise the issue in a county like Weber or Salt Lake, where we're trying to maintain political balance. How can we maintain this balance if we're angering the people we're trying to bring into the coalition? So whenever you try to build a, you know, try to keep up a wide tent, you know, it's a challenge, and that's the challenge that faces Utah Republicanism.
One more question.
Charles S. Varian was a very important person in this process and many of the process around statehood. What was he like as a person?
Don't know. Good question.
It sure would be fun to have more information on him. He was the brunt of several Mormon pranks, including human excrement, things like that, in earlier days. But he was one of the first to realize the need for normalization of Utah politics. He stood up in several Liberal Party meetings and said, hey, it's gone too far. If we're going to oppose the church in politics, we've got to do it from within the Republican and Democratic parties. And he was much criticized for that. But we have almost no information about him or his sometime partner, William Dixon, in their personal lives. I think there was an allegation once back in B.H. Roberts' comprehensive history of frequenting some brothel, but I don't think there's any way to substantiate anything about his personal life.
If there are no more questions, we'd like to thank you all for coming here, and we'd like to thank Leo Lyman and John Sillitoe for their comments. We urge you to stay for the next sessions. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Mark.
Let me see if I understand.